From KCRW, this is DNA, Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. LA has a housing crunch, but lots of apartments seem to be sitting empty.
More than half the lights are not on, but it gives you a pretty good idea that our estimate of 40 to 50% vacancy is about right.
We go on a quest to find out if those fancy new towers are actually being lived in, and the city considers a vacancy tax. But first, Uber has disrupted taxicabs, e-scooters, and bikes. Now the company's airborne division, Uber Elevate, wants to add a ride-hailing service in the sky.
2 years ago, the Elevate team was hardly a handful of people, and most people in the world had only dreamt of flying cars. Now, today, the ever-elusive flying car future we have all envisioned is one step closer.
That was Nikhil Goel. He's head of product at Uber Elevate, and he was speaking at their summit last week. Uber Elevate claims that Uber Air will be ready for liftoff in 2023. And it is thinking now about where these app-based flying taxis will take off and land. The company has floated 8 concepts for what they call skyports to be located in Los Angeles, Dallas, and Melbourne. They were designed pro bono by 8 firms. One of the firms was Gensler. Terence Young designs airports for Gensler's LA office, and he came to our studio to explain their skyport concept, which they chose to locate by the freeway.
An Uber Skyport would be a place for aerial taxi service to land and take off and to exchange passengers from any ground-based mobility. It would be cars or scooters or bikes or however people get around in a city, and then get on an aerial taxi to make longer commutes for, you know, that typically take an hour, hour, 15 minutes. It'll do it in 7 to 10 minutes.
You're not calling this an airplane.
It's not an airplane. What they call it is the eVTOL, which stands for electrically powered vertical takeoff or landing, right? So it acts like a helicopter upon arrival and departure, and it acts like an airplane in flight. It's engineered for multiple passengers. It's engineered for electric power, which is the key to keeping costs down and creating greater sustainability, so and also keeping noise down, right?
How far along is the technology?
There are mock-ups and testing going on, and we're on the birth of testing of these vehicles.
And again, explain to me the difference between a skyport and an airport.
Okay. So an airport is geared typically to take hundreds of passengers, you know, 400, 500 passengers on an A380, right? Baggage, all of these kinds of things. So long haul, long distance, fueling, all of that kind of stuff. This mobility hub is more like a heliport, right? It's situated in the middle of the city, right, as opposed to an airport, which tends to want to be as far away from urban populations as possible. So airspace is geared towards managing larger aircraft, whereas this is geared toward managing craft that are the size of cars.
But doesn't the FAA have to manage all aircraft that are up there in the air and could possibly drop down on people's heads
that
or
is,
houses or
right.
freeways or whatever?
That is an excellent question. Right. So what I learned is the FAA is currently working to certify these aircraft and the airspace for which they would operate, which is below 400 feet. So the airplanes that you're talking about are operating at 400 feet and above. So the idea is that these aerial taxis would be following already driven routes with density and noise via the freeway. So let's think of the 10 freeway or the 405, and you're just expanding into the Z-axis and laying another layer of traffic over that freeway.
So you've essentially created a kind of transportation corridor that's on several levels.
That's correct. Yeah.
But still, all of this is speculative. And what your piece was, mm-hmm. was to design the terminus.
Right, right, right. So the idea here is that if you are designing something for short waiting times, what do people need, right? And the idea here is that at a busy corner near the freeway, underneath this canopy of the flight deck, you could have gyms, right? You could have fresh markets. You could have healthcare. You could have an urgent care. You could have all of these things that people are kind of missing in a place like Los Angeles because our neighborhoods are kind of split up.
So, Terence, your day job at Gensler is to work on real, actual, very large airports. You
yes.
have, I think, five projects going on. You're doing work at LAX. You're doing a huge airport in China. You know a lot about airports. You presumably fly a lot. Mm-hmm. Do you, in your heart of hearts, believe this Uber Air technology is going to take off?
I went to the conference as a doubter, and I came back as a believer because of how Uber has created a community of research and development. They're taking down the barriers to development. They're taking down the barriers to adoption. They're taking the barriers to technology one by one in a very methodical way. And they're engaging designers, thinkers, software engineers, networkers, cities, mayors, policymakers. And I believe what I saw, that there's definitely enough of a wave that you got to get on board and advocate for its safe adoption, for its usage, in order to do the kinds of things that we want to do, which is to cut down on traffic, to give time back to people, to make our communities like less smog-filled and more walkable, right? So our solution does exactly that. Instead of just making a place where things take off and land, it becomes a vibrant community block in itself.
That was Terence Young with Gensler. Now, there's another LA firm that's designed one of the eight Uber Air Skyport concepts, and that is Methune, Hodgetts & Fung. Craig Hodgetts says he has fully drunk the Uber Air Kool-Aid.
First and foremost, it's a transformative idea. It's an idea which Uber has been pursuing, much to my amazement, to kind of harness all forms of mobility and orchestrate them to maximize their utilization.
But your role in all of this, along with the other seven teams, was to come up with a design for something called a skyport. How did you understand the skyport?
We've envisioned ours as a community asset. And so the skyport that we envisioned was one in which we elevated the landing field high above the street, high enough that below the landing field, we could have a public park. But we devised a way to make a transparent landing field above. So looking up, you would see the aircraft landing. The sun will penetrate it, cast shadows down below, and create a very, we think, sublime park-like atmosphere below the parking and landing area.
Now, if they really do function like taxis, what are we going to have? We're going to look up in the sky and just see hundreds, if not thousands, of these. I mean, that sounds awful. Where's the sky?
It is something that's a little daunting, but they did many, many studies of the airspace. And what they've done is create air freeways, which are narrow and which extend quite high into the sky, and channel the traffic along those many layers of aircraft along those corridors so that they're not flying haphazardly all over the place, so that they're going point to point. And Uber says, well, we're going to have in the LA area, hold on to your hat, 70 terminals.
That was Craig Hodgetts with Methune, Hodgetts & Fung. I'm Frances Anderton, you're listening to DNA, and we are talking about Uber Air. Now, the viability of this urban air taxi will be fully tested when the rubber hits the road. That is, when the devices work safely and when they face the approval process with many stakeholders, like aviation officials, community groups, lawmakers and transportation planners, like Salita Reynolds. She heads LA's Department of Transportation. And she says the design concepts for Uber Air skyports are impressive. However,
most of them, sort of from my perspective, still have a little bit of work to do in showing something that really integrates into the fabric of a city. You have a lot of startups and manufacturers and technologists working on really exciting designs for new types of aircraft. You have companies like Uber, Amazon, Walmart, all thinking about creative new ways to deliver goods and move people in congested cities. But you don't necessarily yet have somebody thinking about how this new service exists, solves real problems in cities, and integrates into really complicated systems of systems that we manage and operate. So how do we make sure that we keep safety and quality of life and neighborhoods at the top of the list of things that we care about when we look at some of these designs? What problem does this really solve, and whom is it solving for?
Now, as you understand it, who do you think Uber Air is targeted at, and who do you think will be impacted, and what should be different?
So I think that, first of all, this by its nature, even though I've seen a lot of simulations, will be a capacity-constrained service. There's just only so many seats on so many air taxis that you can fill and have take off and land at really high, sort of high desirability destinations, regional hubs, LAX, Union Station, downtown Los Angeles. So potentially the demand for a limited number of seats will mean that they can sell those seats off at a much higher price. I don't see it as a high capacity service that solves congestion or that even alleviates congestion. I see it as something that is targeted at folks who already have a lot of choices for how they get around and who have disposable income to spend on those choices. And for those folks, you know, that it's, I'm sure it'll be it could be a really great service, but at LADOT, you know, we've sort of lifted up correcting racial and socioeconomic inequities as what we think the role of our department in the transportation system is. So from our perspective, I just want to make sure that, you know, if you live in a lower income neighborhood or you live in a neighborhood that maybe isn't as organized or doesn't have as much influence over these kinds of things, that you don't end up becoming the takeoff and landing pad. And then, you know, your streets become more clogged with Uber X or Uber Black cars pulling up to pick up and drop off customers who are getting on these air taxis.
Sure. Speaking operationally, one of the concepts, as we understand it, for the location of these sky pods is to park them at the beginning and ends of freeways. And so therefore, you'd be driving along the freeway and then above your head, up to 400 feet in the air, might be these flying vehicles racing along in that same linear path. Do you think that's remotely feasible?
So I do think the FAA's role is to certify the safety of these aircraft, and that's going to continue to be there and a really important role for them to play. But I'll just circle back again and say, you know, the history of how we built freeways in the United States is that we did we raised a lot of low-income neighborhoods to build the freeway system, mainly to connect wealthier neighborhoods to opportunities. Those neighborhoods are already getting the negative sort of consequences of being near a freeway. So I would want to be really thoughtful about layering on another sort of service that could potentially exacerbate some of those problems. Even the most efficient of these aircraft are still only hybrid electric, and they still create a lot of pollution. And then the other thing I'll point out is, last count, there's 60-plus companies out there building these new aircraft. Some of them are really quiet, and some of them are really loud. And then, you know, the FAA, you know, lets you fly, but it's the city that needs to be the one that tells you where you can and cannot land.
Lastly, I'm sure that you are part of meetings having to do with planning around transportation for 2028 and the Olympics. Are innovations in urban aircraft being looked at as a possible?
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think we're really excited and bullish about the potential for these services to solve problems around, for example, goods movement, which is really one of the untold success stories of the 84 Games. At LADOT, we like to say that our goal for the 28 Games is to be the global center of autonomous movement, and that includes things on the ground and in the sky. And we just feel like in order for us to get there in a really successful way, we have a good role to play in kind of guiding the rollout and creating a sort of a level playing field, and then move together with these companies towards smart regulations that allow them to scale up in the way that they want to be really successful.
Well, Salita Reynolds, you finished on an up note. And tell me, are you going to be the first to get in one of these Uber Elevates?
You know what? I have, in my travels, I've been going around and visiting a lot of the companies that are working on manufacturing because I want to see them for myself. Most of them have not gone airborne yet. Or they haven't gone airborne with a general manager of the Department of Transportation in them yet. But I'm excited to get in one and really, you know, get a sense of how they work and, you know, how comfortable they are and how loud they are and all of the things that that I'm curious about.
That was Salita Reynolds. She is general manager of the city's Department of Transportation. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, do people really live in the new residential towers that are going up in downtown and other parts of LA? We'll find out.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Thousands of people are living on the streets of Los Angeles, and many others struggle to pay high rents. Yet, more than 100,000 units reportedly sit empty across our city. So, four council members say it's time to impose a vacancy tax, that is, a levy on landlords and property owners who keep rentals vacant. A vacancy tax or empty homes penalty would likely have to go before voters for approval, but it is one of the few housing proposals that appears to have support from people on both sides of the housing divide, the NIMBY or Not In My Backyard and YIMBY or Yes In My Backyard factions. And it may address a question that many of us have been pondering as we watch all the new residential towers going up in LA. Does anyone actually live there? Well, DNA reporter John Reed went to find out.
It's Thursday evening in Los Angeles. The sun is setting. And Walter Dominguez and Brad Kane are hitting the streets.
I figured we'd go down Pico and look at the developments that are going to... they're starting developments.
They're apartment hunting, sort of.
Okay, so we're heading up Crescent Heights Boulevard, and we're heading up to Wilshire, where there's high-rise buildings going up.
You know, if you're talking about luxury housing, this is it.
Ta-da! The Vision. It's called The Vision.
Up ahead is a tall building. The metal and glass seem to glisten from the streetlights below. It's an 18-story tower in the Beverly Grove neighborhood of L.A., built last year. And we're here to look at one thing, the windows.
More than half the lights are not on. But it gives you a pretty good idea that our estimate of 40 to 50% vacancy is about right.
The building does look to be about half full. Just a small scattering of windows are lit up, like an uneven checkerboard.
I drive Crescent Heights all the time. Big building opens up, and I started going, wait, it's dark. And so it became like a thing. So I talked to other people. Hey, are there any lights on? Really? Okay. And so we start talking about it, and to make sure we're not crazy, We start driving around to compare notes.
Walter and Brad are both active in their mid-city neighborhood, South Carthay. They've fought for historic protections and to restrict new development.
This entire neighborhood is vulnerable to destruction. These are all rent-controlled, virtually all rent-controlled housing. It's also beautifully historic.
They love their neighborhood. It's lined with 1920s and 30s Mediterranean-style duplexes. But they're fighting against housing blocks that are big, generic, unaffordable, and worst of all, empty.
We're going to get out and we're going to walk around and see something called The Vins. know that. But this is looks like a disastrous development, not only from my point of view architecturally, but more importantly, it's empty.
Empty, he says.
So where are we? Just to describe
this. We're at the corner of Fairfax and Olympic, and San Vicente cuts across here. So this is like the busiest intersection in our area of town.
This building isn't a high rise. It's four stories, modern, industrial chic, around a shared courtyard and pool. It opened last year. A one bedroom can cost up to $5,000. We walk along the sidewalk on Fairfax, peering into windows on the ground floor.
Well, there's like a dresser and a mirror, but there's nothing that makes it look like a human lives there.
Empty, empty, empty. If you look on the website tonight when you get back, you'll see that, I'd say, more than 50% is still vacant.
I did end up looking on the website. There were 18 apartments listed as available. That's out of 144 units total. One of the property managers, who actually lives on site, told me they're at 91% capacity. From our vantage point across the street, it didn't look that way.
I come to the Starbucks often, and I come and I always look at the VINs to see what's going on, because tonight there's actually more lights than usual. Looks like there are four lights over there, and usually it's mostly dark.
Walter Dominguez and Brad Kane have been monitoring activity in new residential buildings for about 2 years. It started with them wondering, like perhaps many of us have, how come so many costly apartments are being built? Is there that much demand?
All right, let me jump back to my database so I can get you the most up-to-date numbers. Bear with me here.
Stephen Basham is with real estate analytics firm CoStar. He's been crunching the numbers on multifamily development in L.A.
Before 2018, there were 18 of these luxury high-rise buildings built in the history of Los Angeles. In 2018, 9 more of these buildings opened their doors. So the overall supply of luxury high-rises increased by 50% last year alone.
Basham says that pretty much everything that's getting built here now is this sort of sleek, luxury development, what CoStar calls Class A.
There's not much construction going on sort of outside that Class A product.
And, he says, the overall vacancy rate in L.A. County is low, 3.8%, which is below the historical average, even though the dark windows in those midtown buildings spotted by Walter and Brad might suggest otherwise. But Basham's data only tracks market-rate apartment units, not single-family homes and not affordable housing. He tracks roughly 1 million market-rate units in new residential towers and older buildings. So that translates to about 38,000 vacancies.
You've had a ton of these projects deliver in a very short time frame.
He says most of the construction has been concentrated downtown, and it is there that you will find most vacancies.
It's not a lack of demand or a lack of interest in what's going on. It's that you have thousands of new units delivering pretty much every year, and that's just a lot for the area to absorb in a short amount of time.
Like Alina downtown, a 30-story steel and glass tower at a prime location, the corner of 9th and Flower.
We are a brand new community. We have 341 units. We have studios all the way to 3 bedrooms.
This is Diana Hong, Alina's property manager.
And price ranges starting at $2,270 all the way to $10,000, which are our penthouse units.
The building opened late last year.
So we are currently leased at 53%.
That means that out of their 341 units, about 160 are sitting vacant, at least for now.
Our goal is to reach 95% by December, but lately we've been doing really well. So we're crossing our fingers that we can be successful by October.
Most people who rent live there, she says, and don't simply hold on to apartments as second homes. But the property reserves 10% of their apartments for corporate leasing, which might account for some of those darkened windows. But there are still other types of rentals sitting unoccupied in LA, in older multifamily buildings and single-family homes. Enough that City Councilman Mike Bonin and 3 of his colleagues want to target them.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here today. Marquise Harris-Austin, Paul Koretz, and David Rue and I are going to be introducing a motion to the City Council.
Last week, a coalition of city officials and housing advocates announced a proposal to tax landlords with empty housing units. Councilman Bonin cited census data that suggests LA has above 100,000 unoccupied rentals. Here's Councilman Marquise Harris Dawson.
This measure simply says, if you want to have a housing unit in this city while we are in this crisis, and you insist on keeping it vacant, you're going to participate in helping us solve the problem, and you're going to do it in a financial way.
The city has not yet determined how to apply this tax, but the goal is to make more apartments available and raise revenue to build more affordable housing. It has the support of people on both sides of the housing debate.
This was not the case of an elected official going out and bringing people from disparate points of view together. This was disparate points of view coming together with a sense of urgency and coming to the city and saying, we are together on this. Please act.
A vacancy tax has been tried in a number of other places, like Paris and Vancouver, and was recently approved in Oakland. Scott Weiner has expressed interest in the concept. He's the San Francisco state senator who recently introduced the controversial SB 50, which would override local zoning to force more housing construction. He spoke to DNA soon before the bill was shelved in committee.
Well, I am very open to allowing cities to employ a vacancy tax. I know they implemented that in Vancouver. I've heard mixed results about whether it's working, but that is an idea that I do believe we should explore. And I'm, at least in concept, in favor of it.
And so are Brad Kane and Walter Dominguez, who fought hard against SB 50.
It is something that could be done without having to tear up an entire community, disperse people, lose rent control. Won't solve everything, but it's part of the whole package.
So could a vacancy tax work in LA? I asked Paul Sullivan. He's a tax specialist in Vancouver.
Will it bring more homes to the rental market? Potentially. Will it make a meaningful difference? Probably not.
Sullivan stresses the need for good data. Vancouver, he says, learned the hard way when they introduced their vacancy tax. Once they really dug into it, their initial estimate of 25,000 vacancies fell well below that.
Really, before you spend the millions of dollars in implementing a new tax, especially in a vast city like LA, make sure it's going to be meaningful. Because it's very expensive to do, and then it's very expensive to maintain it.
So, while a vacancy tax could do some good, many who've explored it argue that the real problem is lack of supply.
The ultimate problem is that we just simply don't have enough housing to go around to everyone who wants a home. That means that the homes that are there go to the people who can pay the most for them.
Michael Castle Miller is a legal and policy advisor based in LA. He says the city is experiencing a normal level of vacancies. But he does wonder why the rental prices in these fancy new apartment buildings haven't dropped a bit.
Normally, when there's an oversupply, the price drops because the owners are desperate to start making some income off the property, even if that means charging less than what they were hoping to get for it.
He speculates that property owners are sitting on such hot real estate that they can afford to let a few units sit empty until the right renter comes along. As for Walter and Brad, our empty apartment spotters, they think the vacancy tax is worth a shot.
There's a Chinese saying, a crisis is a combination of the symbol for danger and opportunity. And so while we're in this crisis, we also have some opportunities to take that and translate that into a positive agenda.
Maybe then they can stop spending their nights counting dark windows. For DNA, I'm John Reed.
And I'm Frances Anderton, and that's it for today's DNA. Avishai Altsy produced and edited the show with a final mix by Ray Guana. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week.